said talk to me, damn it, or else I'm gonna throw you in the fire!
You stupid bitch, you filthy!
Welcome back to Flyover State of Fear. I got another great guest, a returning guest, Lon from Honest Trailers or from the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. How you doing, Lon?
I'm pretty good. Thanks, Rob. That's right, Invasion of the Body. I was trying to think of what did we talk about the last time.
We spoke about it.
I did not remember until you just said it right
now. We spoke of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and I vividly remember telling you, all right, I'll actually have you on next time to talk about Don't look now. The
Nicholas Rogue, Donald Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland. I still have A yet to watch, and I did not talk to you about that. We're talking about Nope today.
That one's great, though. Well, it's, at some point.
We'll get to it. It's on that, you know, invisible list.
It is. I do feel weird. That is one of those like film bro, old school, like nerdy, esoteric, like, oh, you got to see Don't Look Now. Like when I was first coming up as a movie fan, that was the gratuitous, every movie fan picks it as their favorite, like classy, artsy horror movie.
Yeah,
so like, if you were older, you would definitely have seen it. It was like a hacky. It was like a Fight Club level pick.
Sure. Well, that's
but
like me.
I feel like that's already old now, and people forget it again. So
that's like me getting mad at my brother on Thanksgiving for like purposely digging at me about like Raging Bull and Taxi Driver. You know, the film bro-ness
of
like,
that's
what do you mean?
Don't look now.
Like, you know. Yeah, and he was just getting under my skin, and I was just like, you just don't like 70s slow burn. You know. Anyway. So one day I'll do that, but probably about a year, how's it going? And, everything.
It's going. We're not leaving the house.
Good. I don't want to leave the house. We also have Taco here, by the way.
Taco's here. Yeah.
Joining us. Hi, Taco.
Taco. Well, I've said this on a bunch of podcasts when I do, cause I live here alone, just me and Taco. So 99% of the time, if I'm speaking out loud in my normal everyday voice, like I am right now, it's to this guy. It's like, well, we're going on a walk or it's time for eat. It just so happens sometimes I talk about Nope on podcasts with people and then he doesn't understand. He's like, who is he talking to? He can see there's nobody else here. He doesn't understand Zoom.
I have a Jordan Peele Funko Pop I found at Five Below, so maybe you could talk to him.
Yeah, I just like, from Taco's perspective, that's still just a screen. It's like, I might as well be watching
Taco,
something.
He doesn't
get that you're there and we're interacting.
I'll ask for his opinion, and if he chimes in, it's the one to go with. I'll appreciate what Taco has to say about.
He's pretty simple. He's more of a Black Adam guy.
I'm holding off on putting the $20 out until it's a rental. Put it that way.
It's gonna be a great. Oh, Black Adam's on HBO Max.
That's
the exact right level for Black Adam.
Work
I enjoyed
movie.
It, but it's Work. A perfect that you know how they get like prestige things on HBO Max get the gold button.
Yeah,
like when they're like really like. Oh, you're going to want to hit play on this bad boy.
And that's
Black
Adam.
That's a perfect Black Adam. That's exactly, it's a gold button HBO Max pick.
I can't wait, because I'm looking forward to it. But it's a work day, gold button, you know, ooh, this is there. All right.
It reminds me of, the last thing I'll say.
Oh, yeah, go.
It reminds me of from before there were, like, classy tentpole mainstream, everybody's into comic book movies, when comic book movies were still, like, a thing that everybody looked down on that were for 14-year-old boys exclusively. This feels like it was like beamed from that era to today. If this had never become a mainstream genre and we were still doing 90s comic book movies, it's exactly on that level.
So that's a better sell than anyone else has done. The director's cut of Daredevil.
I mean, better than Daredevil, not as good as Blade, but
or X2. From
that, but of that era. It feels Perfect. Like of that one-off era where it's just like, we picked a random character from the DC library, and we are putting five other
like
random-ass characters in there with them, and they are going to punch the hell out of each other over a random city.
I like that. That's what Venom... the yeah. sequel felt like.
Right.
Venom and yes. the Sea. I actually enjoyed it for that reason. I was like, this exactly. is just fun.
It's nice it's to goofy. Sometimes take a step away from like the big overarching franchise
type oh.
filmmaking and just do one-off silly ones like
this. I was talking about, I know this is about horror, but whatever. I was talking about that recently because I was talking about Wakanda Forever, which I really liked. But, you know, with that whole, with the whole MCU and everything, I'm like, going, no, now I'm going to start kind of nitpicky, plot holy, because they gave me that lane to do this every fucking day.
Right.
So, that's a breath of fresh air. So, I will see Black Adam out, and I will report to Taco about it.
There you go.
But do you have any actual recommendations or anything before we get into Nope? Have you watching recently?
Like stuff on VOD or...
Yeah, anything anyone you'd be interested of telling anyone to check out?
Well,
or...
I definitely enjoyed, it's brand new on Netflix. I don't know how soon this will go up, but Emily the Criminal is now going to be on Netflix. That was really good. Like this kind of low key crime thriller that I just watched the other night.
The Aubrey Plaza one.
Yeah. Aubrey Plaza. Great. And it's just, you know, it's a thriller. It's a crime story, but it's not trying to build the like, a huge epic mm-hmm. blowout. It's just like a very realistic kind of simple story that's very well told.
Perfect.
She's great in it. I really like that. There's another one that's on VOD right now. I feel like it may be more easy to watch. Like you don't have to pay for it by the mm-hmm. time you people out there are listening to it. So Google it. It's called Soft and Quiet. It is
okay.
an indie movie. It's definitely going to be on my like top 10 or 20 for this year. This low budget indie. All shot, it's like told in real time. I think they fudged it a little bit. It's made to look like it's basically like unbroken shots. Or like
sure, okay,
a
like
few
a Bert
unbroken
Manny.
Shots. And you're watching, it's a group of women and they're having this kind of community icebreaker, get to know you sort of meeting. And so for a while you're like, is it a book club? Is it a neighborhood watch? Why are these women meeting? What are they really doing together? I don't want to reveal anymore.
Okay,
but there
that's
are,
it. I'm
there
sold.
Are, it's a thriller, and there are crazy layers to this onion.
I'm
and
sold.
It's cool. It's well done. Yeah.
All right. Appreciate it. So, thank you for those recs. I am looking forward to watching both of those. I know my co-host Brian just watched the Emily
the Criminal. Yeah.
Emily the
Which
Criminal
I,
last
it was
night.
In theaters, and I wanted to catch it, but I didn't catch it in theaters, and now it's on Netflix, and everybody can see
but
it.
And soft really and quiet it sounds even better. So, we're talking about Nope today, and the reason, one of the many reasons I want to talk to Lon again, but also, I saw Lon tweeting out about Nope, of just how much he loves this movie, and you
yeah,
just,
really,
you know, a really nice analysis of it. And I had watched it once, and full disclosure, I was like, it's my third favorite Jordan Peele film. It didn't really connect with me. But that's how his first two movies kind of happened for myself. And then I watched them on rewatches, and now I've seen both Get Out and Us. Probably Get Out a lot, I think. Get Out, you know, I mean, it's Get Out. It's one of the best movies of our last decade. And I think Us has aged really well, and it is better on rewatches.
I think he's that kind of a filmmaker. I feel like the Coens and Paul Thomas Anderson have always been that way for me, too. Where the first time I see them, it's like the preliminary round. It's like, all right, let's see how this one washes over me. But I really need to see them two or three times to fully get how I'm going to end up feeling about them. And a lot of them change a lot, my take on them between like that second and third viewing. So I knew I liked Nope right away, but it was like the third or fourth time through that I was like, oh, I think this is my favorite. Like, this is,
like,
there's a lot going on here that I really like.
It's really neat. So before I begin, I do read, I wasn't sure if, I don't remember if I did it on your episode or I started doing it after you had joined me. So I've been reading the synopsises, but blind, that they give on when you just Google it, because they're usually real hit or miss. It'll be like, Jordan Peele's new alien movie.
Right. Yeah.
You know, or an actual description. So this is really short. A man and his sister discover something sinister in the skies above their California horse ranch. While the owner of a nearby theme park tries to profit from the mysterious otherworldly phenomenon. That's a very good and accurate description.
I wouldn't say it's a theme park. That's the one place I would... It's a roadside attraction.
Yeah,
maybe an amusement park.
It also...
Theme park makes it sound like it's Knott's Berry Farm.
It kind of gives a spoiler a bit in it, too, because I do like the reveal that that Jupe, you know, and that the theme park, the roadside attraction,
yeah,
that now they're like, no, here, we know about the aliens, and here they are. And
yeah, I don't know if I would give that away. For Inside Streaming, the newsletter I write about what's coming up on streaming, I do these every day. I write my own... I do a daily calendar and I write my own capsule summaries. And you know, a lot of the time I look at the ones that are in like IMDb or Google or whatever, because I'm hoping that's going to be enough information for me to write my own. Almost never is.
If so I haven't seen it,
I have to go look it up independently on my own to figure out what it's really about almost every time, because those are like a man and a woman go on a magical journey. And it's
that's everything. That's why I started reading them. I think it was actually Janine who did Scream, Janine Bryce, from the Schmodown one, and we did Scream, and I'm 90% positive her write up was like the iconic horror movie by Wes Craven. You know, it was jargon.
Yeah, it's amazing how often those are just like don't really give you any information about the movie.
So this one's one of the better ones. I'll give it like
a
B minus. Right. So anyway, I think I find really interesting about Jordan Peele and his movies, he's joined the spectacle of directors, right? Of like, you're excited about the director, not about the content itself. Like, Jordan Peele has a new movie right now. Bam. It has a baked-in audience. We're going to see it. And all of the things that he likes to dissect about the movie. So the one fun fact that I kind of found about it, and would have been interested in anyway, is what other movies influenced this movie? Because I remember you reading about Get Out's influences, and especially Us. That was like a big hot topic of like... I remember seeing the sections of Society because of the movie posters.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this one's pretty obvious. King Kong, Jurassic Park, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Signs, and The Wizard of Oz were like, he cites as his big influences.
I definitely feel like Westerns are also in there. And not, like, obviously there's like cowboy stuff and horse stuff because they're on a horse ranch. But even just like the way a lot of the action scenes are set up. I mean, he does a thing during one of the big climactic sequences. He's using these inflatable tube men.
I love that. I mean,
and it helps you follow the action. And that does feel like ripped from classic Hollywood filmmaking, where they would give you signposts and directors like even like John Ford or Anthony Mann would use the landscape to kind of tell the story in that way.
Yeah.
So I feel like that was also in his mind. Maybe.
No, that's a great point. I mean, it's so night and vivid, and you can pick it apart and like, those wacky inflatable tube men, I remember the trailer, because that's what captured me in the trailer, because you kind of chuckle at them, and then finding out, yeah, like you said, how they're used in the movie is these, like, field posts.
To orient your eye and, like, let you know, help you follow everything, and that, it's a thing that, it bugs me a lot in movies, so it's nice to see a director pay a lot of attention to it. If you hear the greatest action directors speak, they all talk about this all the time. John Woo, Michael Mann, Michael Bay even, where it's like, it's so key to keep the audience, like, even if you're jumping around in space a lot, the audience always has to know where the main character is, where the person they're fighting is, where they are in space in relation to each other. And the moment that a movie starts to break down, that's when an action scene gets, like, less interesting. And I was saying this about The Gray Man earlier this year, that... Like, the Russo brothers don't pay attention to this. And it's like, it's not even like they're not skilled enough. They just don't seem to care. They're just like, okay, now you're on top of the train. Okay, now you're on top of the building. Okay, now you're on the ground. And, like, you spend half the movie looking for where Ryan Gosling is or where he's going.
That sucks.
Or who's shooting who. And, like, Jordan Peele just innately makes sure that you always know who's where they're going. Spielberg, obviously, is, like, a master at this. Like, the best set pieces are always, like, very fixed in space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you go back, I think a great example is the minecart chase in Temple of Doom. I know not everybody's favorite. Listen.
It's fun. It's fun.
Not everybody's favorite Indiana Jones movie. I still like it. But the minecart chase, it's very chaotic in terms of the motion. They're moving fast. There's
but I know where they're going.
There's a bunch of different cars, but the camera's always oriented with Indy and his car. Mm-hmm. So even... we always know where we're looking at, what we're looking at, you know, even in which direction. He can turn it 180, but we always know where we are and where Indy is. And that's how your eye knows where to go during the whole scene.
It's smart.
He makes it seem easy. You know, Spielberg makes it seem obvious, but then you watch other movies that don't do that. You're like immediately like, what am I looking at? That's a foot.
I like that you brought up the gray man because, online and myself and you, and we always make fun of those streamer action movies, you know, your Red Notices and shit anyway.
Yeah, and this is like, part of where that breaks down. Like, those action movies, they might be big budget and they're blowing things up and the stunts and they're still doing it. It's just if you can't tell what's happening, it's just not, it's not as interesting.
Yeah.
Or interesting at all.
That's a great point. I love that. And, that definitely goes into what this movie, like, he wanted it to be, right? He wanted this movie to be this spectacle because it was born out of the pandemic.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like this does much more so, like, Us feels very much like it is in a, like, horror movie homage place. Like, that's a vintage horror movie setup that these, like, murderous doubles show up. And it's always about building tension.
It's the horror. Like,
right. It's a classic sort of horror.
There's no horror. I mean, there's horror in this movie, but there's no classic horror.
There are scary sequences, but I feel like if you're really looking at like what is the root of this, it's almost like an action. It's an action movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a big summer monster action movie, and like honestly, in terms of the storytelling and stuff, it's almost kind of more similar to something like Tremors than a conventional horror.
Yeah. You know what? I just spoke about it, but it reminded me of it. It also has a lot of notes of the Spielberg moments of, I just spoke about Poltergeist, but the Spielberg moments of Poltergeist. So not the horror in Poltergeist, but like the moments, like the scene with, by the way, we'll work our way through the movie, but the scene with the ranch and the spectacle when you meet them, that reminded me of the chair scene in Poltergeist so much.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, Jaws, too, is a point that he's riffing on. You know, it's like this mission to catch this creature. And it's like a monster movie in one way, but it's also about the people who go searching for the monster and the adventure.
The biggest rip from Jaws to me is that scene, right? The ending, your ending kind of climax, right? Where they're trying to catch the monster. The music, the score,
right?
It's not the you know, the tense Jaws music,
right?
It's like the ending of them swimming away, like it's the happiest adventure western.
That bouncy sort of 60s, we're going on the mission, western music, exactly.
And like, there's very few times where you get like the horror score plays in, and you know,
it's also just that Jaws has that, it's that awareness of the point in the movie when it transitions. It's here, this has been the setup, this has been the scary stuff, the shark is attacking people in the ocean, but once they get on the ship, Spielberg has that amazing shot, it's because he's Spielberg, where you actually zoom into the shark's mouth, like there's that skeleton, a shark jaw, and the boat is heading out, and you zoom through the shark jaw to watch them leap, and that's the dividing point, that's the act one to act two moment, where it's like, okay, we're leaving Amity, now it's these guys, and they're going out into the unknown on this mission, and the movie is the movie is shifting into adventure mode. And I feel like that's really a lot of what Peele's doing in this. You get the setup. Here's their motivation. We're getting to know the characters. But then once it becomes like, okay, we got to get this footage. We've got all our guys together. It becomes this, like, you know, mission. It becomes this adventure movie.
Sure. I love that. So the movie does start out. The movie does start out in, like, the most interesting spot. You hear this audio of an old sitcom. You immediately know, I think it's supposed to, like, it's supposed to be like late 80s, like, what, Friday night kind of.
Yeah, I feel like this is it's an Alf era. When sitcoms always had, like, very big, wacky gimmicks. Like, that was an 80s thing for sure.
Goofy. So it starts off with that, but it starts off with this, like, bloody shoe standing straight up. And that's another great, like, iconography that just very focuses on it. And
That's one of those things that people get so. Like, I had a lot of conversations about this movie where people were like, why is the shoe standing up? Things like that are in movies to tickle your brain.
Yeah, it's
to make you think about it, not because there's a good answer that's going to, like, lead you to the next clue. Movies are not escape rooms. It's not about, like, oh, I'm going to find the code here, and then I go to the mailbox. Whatever you think. Like, I have a theory on why I think that's there, but I like the idea that we're always seeing those scenes through the eyes of Jupe. This was like this traumatic moment arguably the defining moment in his life. I think that's kind of the crux of the whole movie kind of falls back on this, but we can talk about that later. But I do think in some ways the way that Peele is shooting that sequence is it's about how he's remembering it. It's not necessarily a reflection of exactly what happened. It's about how he's remembering this trauma. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you live through a traumatic event, the way that your brain remembers it is one detail. You pick out a detail from the room or a detail from the scene, and it sticks out in your mind beyond all the other things, chaotic things that were happening. That becomes like a summary of that moment for you.
Right.
And so to me, I feel like that was, he noticed this shoe standing up oddly, and that sticks out for him about that. And it became a defining thing about that scene because he was trying not to look at the murderous chimpanzee.
No, he was just looking
at
the
shoe. He would have looked over there and he might have noticed the shoe standing up.
I think you nailed that. And I know it's like literally frame one of the movie, but I think you nailed that analysis of it. And that makes sense to me, especially when you see it later in his museum.
Right.
It's
well,
there.
That, to me, that's the center. We'll just go.
To
me, a lot of what the movie's really about, I don't want to say the movie's really about. A lot of what's going on in the movie, I think, is about how the media and communication and the innate desire to experience this thing and share it gets so tied up with, like, class and capitalism and money and the idea that if you film something, if you record something, if you capture something, it's sort of this inherently exploited relationship on one level that you can't help but, like, you're commodifying something by filming it, packaging it, turning it into a movie. But at the same time, we crave that as people. We all want to be in movies. We'd love to be the center.
We want the drama.
We're begging to be exploited in this way. And I think that the movie is really about that tension. And it's reflected in Dan Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer's characters that he just wants to make money. He doesn't want any attention. He's like, don't even look at me. I don't even want to talk to you. Here's the horse. Film what you got to film and I'm going to get out of here. Mm-hmm. And then Kiki Palmer's exactly the opposite. He's like, screaming, hey, I'm going to do craft services. Call me for this. What do you want to do for that? You know, she's like,
I'm a personality. I could do everything.
A showman.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the innate tension. And it's perfectly captured in both angles by Steven Yeun's character because this is the most horrific thing that's happened to him, obviously, and he's utterly traumatized by it.
Yes.
And yet, he has a museum dedicated to it. It's the most important thing that's happened to him as well. And that monologue that he gives, one of the year's best monologues where he's recalling the Saturday Night Live sketch.
And
where it means both things to him at the same time. It's the most devastating, awful thing that happened to him, and it's his peak.
It's his career now.
It's his. It's the best thing, the most amazing thing that ever happened to him, the most interesting thing that will ever happen to him, all together. And like that to me is like the tension of the whole movie.
Sure. No, I love that you went through that, and we're kind of starting off going through talking about that because I was really wondering, you know, where that was coming from. That monologue or that SNL, it's great too, because also, you know, I would have saved it for then, but if you're familiar, especially with that era, like, I could see that sketch in my head. I don't need...
Sure.
I know exactly. When he was like, Chris Kattan played the monkey, I'm like, yeah, Mr. Peepers.
Right. And, you know, it's Kattan. He's killing it.
Yeah. Legendary. Check it out. But we do get that, like, little nugget beforehand, and then always love to see Keith David, who's playing Danny Clue's father and Kiki Palmer's father, and they're just talking. You kind of get the vibe of the thing, and a mysterious shit falls from the sky and kills him, gets him right in the eye, and we kind of then just kind of go off of what, about 6 months, a year later, to Danny Kaluuya. Basically, they're just trying to survive the business. You could tell right from them. He's on a film set, and you already kind of said it. He's just there to do the horse. And right. The film crew is talking shit about him because I guess they have worked with Keith David for forever, and he probably was a pro. He was probably the perfect blend of Dan, his son, and his daughter. You know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think part of what this movie is kind of doing too, in just a fun way, is in a little bit of a way, it feels like a salute to like the below the line people who work on movie sets, and it is a celebration of all those people that are really doing the day to day work of making movies, but who aren't the director or the stars or the people that always get sort of celebrated. And yeah. I mean, obviously, it's shining a light on the history of, you know, black creators in Hollywood, and like these animal trainers and these true stories.
That is true. The animal trainer.
Right. And I think, you know, he's sort of standing in for all of that. But I think also it's just, you know, the nobility of these jobs and the dedication that it takes to make movies, and how it really is. Like, I think, you know, they're not making a conventional movie, but in the same way, this is kind of, it captures that, the camaraderie of a film set and how a film is a whole bunch of people like working together in like a community kind of setting. And like Dolomite, that Eddie Murphy Dolomite movie,
so I think good.
Beautifully plays on that same theme. But this is kind of that same thing too, is like, you know, even the kid from Fry's, Brandon Perez, I think is the actor's name. You know, even he becomes part of this kind of collective because it's hard work, and it takes a lot of dedication, and it takes a lot of teamwork and collaboration to like make something creative. And and I think that is kind of what I think Keith David is doing there, is he just has so much gravitas. He's a guy that when he shows up in a movie, we're all excited to see him. So I think it expresses, like, you know, there are all these like legendary unsung heroes working behind the scenes on movies, making these movies possible that most people never even know were there.
Well, it sounds like, and kind of going, it's like, when would you ever think to do a story about the animal wranglers, right? Like on a set, you know, the closest thing I could think of in my head is a throwaway bit in 30 Rock.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it goes and plays back into that same idea I was talking about of like the sort of inherent exploitation of filming things. Mm-hmm. Like when it's a human, it's consensual. I could be like, yeah, hey, can I, you know, you want to be in my movie? But when it's an animal, now it's a different, they can't sign on to be commodified in this way. You're kind of just like capturing their essence.
No, you have a monkey that lets loose. You have a horse that needs to let loose.
And how exactly, and how unnatural in some ways it is for them that like they don't, like as soon as the sort of mirror is turned on the horse's eye, it freaks out. It doesn't understand what we're doing. This is a uniquely human impulse. And, and it's not a mistake, obviously, in terms of the symbolism of the whole movie, that the monster both resembles a camera in terms of having you know,
the shutter kind of
lenses and exactly shutters that open up and an eyeball. Like, yes. It looks like an eyeball from the air looking down on them.
Well, let's talk about, just the names of the characters themselves, right? They represent spectacle and things from, like, history and society. I mean, OJ, I think, is pretty obvious, right? It's an exploitative thing that was watched, and I think, it's very on purpose that it's OJ Simpson.
It is the fact that it is about a guy who leads another character on a Bronco chase.
Yeah, it
is that. I mean, it feels too cheesy to be purposeful, but it is part of the movie.
Oh no, see, I wasn't referring to that. I just meant scene.
I'm adding that, but the idea of just OJ being a subject of public fascination.
Yeah, and the point of view you bring up of watching even Emerald. I mean, Wizard of Oz, this place you look at, and Kiki Palmer is the star of this movie. I mean, she steals scene for scene for me. I personally don't understand what Jupe is, but I'm sure that means something. Not like the naming of Jupe. I don't actually know, so I'm not going to assume. And yeah, those kind of names.
Well, because his name's not really Jupe. That was the character he played. Yeah, he was
Little
Kid Sheriff. Little Jupe was Kid Sheriff.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some symbolism there. I mean, the other names are...
Well, I think it's that he... It's this alter ego. It's mm-hmm. an, it's another mm. him. It's both him, but it was not him. And then he's adopted that for the rest of his life.
His wife, his kids.
He's now a grown
kids.
Man. He's still going by Jupe. He's still living as this character. Again, because... being the center of those shows and film, that was everything mm-hmm. for him. That was defining for him. It's mm-hmm. more real than his real life because it's famous.
And he probably floated. I'm just adding story in for Lil Jupe, but he probably floated around after that incident of like barely getting jobs here or there. And
sure, I mean, I think you can read that in that he would have preferred to. Kept his acting career going, but probably it did not survive into becoming an adult and not being cute anymore.
So another motif I really like, and this is kind of right after...
not that Steven Yeun isn't a good-looking guy. I'm just
he's a very handsome man.
Within the story, people, come on.
I know. Lon.
They're very attractive.
It's an attractive cast. But the one, and then, so the way Jordan Peele, he cuts the film up, right? So we have the, just kind of meeting everyone, talking about the dynamics of everyone in the film sets, and they actually go to Lil Jupe to meet him, to drop off their horse Lucky, and what I really love is the title cards of everything is looks like a, when the light's on, or off, on, before or after a screening, of a big screen, which then it says Lucky or Nope or Jean Jacket, and it's a stage or a silver screen.
It's right. The whole movie is these kind of layers of story and storytelling.
And so they go there, and from then I to bring Lucky to him, because what they've been doing is they've been selling horses to this sideshow attraction, this little theme, sideshow theme park, I think is the best to kind of that they did that Ricky runs. And this is where when we get the monologue about the incident. This is the where we get the monologue and the SNL sketch and all of that. And there's some really cool I'm always interested in knowing what someone like Jordan Peele uses with numbers, and he says 6 minutes and 13 seconds. It's mentioned quite a few times. That's how long it took for that incident to go on. He remembers the time frame. I found one article. It's biblical senses with that number, but I'm pretty sure it's more actually baked in Judaism. And I wish I wrote down what it was, but it's actually.
I tend to not. I mean, maybe that's purposeful, maybe not.
Oh, okay.
To me, it's like, I don't feel like most filmmakers are going into making these movies like, I'm going to embed riddles.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
People are going to look up Bible verses and figure out, like, maybe Jordan Peele's doing that and he's functioning on that level and he's churchy like that. And, like, that is certainly possible.
I always say that because
I tend to feel like that's weird internet people who want to, like, solve the movie. Like, yeah. I'm going to get the
and
answer.
And this is what,
like,
this means. And
that doesn't sound like the kind of thing a guy, I don't know. To me, I have a hard time with that.
Okay.
Unless it was like, I need a number. I'm going to, we'll pick a,
I had heard the number a few times in the movie.
I don't want to say you're definitely wrong. To me, when people start to back up their film theories with, like, well, but if you go back to the Book of Daniel, and, like, I'm like,
yeah.
I didn't write it down, so it's not important.
I didn't think about it that much. I didn't write it down.
Because, even in like English class, like if you study literature, a big thing is like, well, would the audience of the time appreciate this reference? Mm-hmm. Like, we don't just say Shakespeare could have been referring to this incident. It'd be like, but would the Elizabethan English audience know about that incident?
Yeah.
And I think Peele is like Shakespeare in this way, that he would be thinking about, is this a reference that is common enough for people to know versus like eight people who go to church every day are going
to
get this.
He wants to put
this
in a Terminator reference before he puts in.
That's how I feel. So I tend to be like, there are always those articles where it's like 18 biblical references hidden in this thing. And it's like,
yeah, that's kind of where I,
whatever
I
you
it.
Say, man.
And
unless it's
only,
Father Stew, I don't think so.
Dude, I don't want to get off Father Stew. I couldn't believe they were releasing it under a new name this weekend.
I thought it was, I legit have thought for weeks that this was a sequel. I thought they knocked out, because, like, you know, it was a real guy. Maybe more stuff happened to him.
No,
I was like, that is amazing. Wahlberg went right back out, and, like, they made a second one after this one was so big in the same year. Very impressive. Ty West did it with X and Pearl.
Yeah.
Good job, Mark Wahlberg. And then, no, it's literally just the same fucking movie.
Do it. Do yourself a favor. Go on AMC Theaters, the website, and watch the trailer they made for Reborn. It's 20 seconds. It re-looks like a parody.
I have not seen the film. I can't speak to the film Father Stew.
I mean either. But the VO of Father Stew of the 22nd Reborn is like an early internet, like The Shining parody. Like Salisbury Hill's playing. And
right,
Anyway. No, I just brought that up because of the beginning of the movie does start with a passage.
And there are definitely Bible, biblical references. Yeah. I don't mean to say that. And the one thing I do think is compelling is the design of the alien or the creature at the end. There are Bible passages that make angels sound that
way. I didn't pick that up.
They're huge and they're terrifying and it's all wings and feathers. And, like, we tend to picture them as, you know, they're basically people with wings and like gold circles. But in the Bible, there's all kinds of crazy descriptions of them. And that, to me, doesn't feel like so obscure that nobody would possibly pick
up on it. I mean, the character's name is literally Angel in the movie.
Right. That one didn't feel like too impossible for me. And I like kind of picked up on that. But it's when it becomes like, well, if you're not a Talmudic scholar, you wouldn't have known this off the top of your head.
I don't think he's throwing
Kabbalah at people.
If I were watching this to not talk to you, I would have never even put that into a search bar. So right after that, they're like, that's kind of weird. You know, you learn about the incident, they learn about everything. We just get a lot more character moments between Dana Kaluuya and Keke Palmer. Basically, Dana Kaluuya is, as you said earlier, I need to make money and my dad's legacy can't die because it's important that he helped revolutionize something. And Keke Palmer is just like, she's there, but she doesn't live in the house. She wants to be an actress. And they go back to the house. And I do love the hobby when he's like, I got hobby weed. She's like, all right, I'm down to hang out because he didn't want to hang out. He just wanted to go to sleep, put his horses away. And they're vibing. And it's best scenes. Like you said earlier, it's the Spielberg moments of just characters hanging out. They this comes back later. They reminisce about that and the Jean Jacket story. Basically, the Jean Jacket story is Keith Palmer going, you stole the one time I thought I was going to be responsible for one of these horses. Without even knowing I stole it. Because Dad gave it to you to take care of this horse. That comes up later because he names the ending thing Jean Jacket. And it's now everyone's responsibility to have that shared movie experience.
I think it's tying everything they're doing to the past and to their job. A lot of the sort of if you're talking about it in terms of like a conventional movie story, the internal conflict for those characters, OJ and his sister specifically, is like living up to their dad's legacy, saving the business, not being screw ups who destroy the legacy of this 100-year-old thing that they're doing. And so even though the movie stops really being about their horse training business.
No.
We still get to follow that through line and them getting to feel like a success by the end at the task of animal wrangling, just in this other way. And so I think that's what Peele is doing by tying this to, this is a redemptive moment for that. This is OJ, even at the end, is wearing the Scorpion King crew sweatshirt that he earned. And that, it's again, it's tying it all together. It's like, this is his final task. He learned from his father.
Yeah.
Now he's a professional, and he's going to wrangle the ultimate animal that anybody has ever
could ever get. And he figured out it was the animal, too.
Exactly. And he's the one who put together how to catch it and how it reacted. And exactly.
So that all goes on, but they notice Ghost. Another title card name pops. You know, I think we get a title card for Ghost. If not, we don't. But Ghost pops up, and Ghost is like out of the stables and like where he shouldn't be at that time of day. And they go out, and he's like, "What's wrong?" And they see in the distance something like flashing over the amusement park, the theme park, kind of going on. And there's just kind of odd commotion, but nothing bad happens. I mean, Ghost runs away, but nothing, no big saucer happens. He sees a saucer, but nothing traumatic happens yet. Danny Kaluuya comes running in, and he tells Keke Palmer, and she knows to take him seriously, because he's only serious. And he's like, I saw a flying saucer, we need to capture it, and as you said, it's the capitalism. Well, if we get it on video, we can make money and sell it, and this is the biggest discovery. Cut for a little bit there, but we were talking about just like the bad miracle part. I really liked that, and yes, to his sister about a bad miracle.
And we were tying it into biblical stuff.
Yeah. Obviously, I didn't even mean to bring that to biblical. I just meant
and biblical references.
I didn't even mean to be. I just, like, it's that good question, and it gets brought up, and but, you know, electricity's out, they see the flying saucer, and I do find the low-key, Danny Kaluuya really makes me laugh in this movie. Especially...
It's a very funny, and it's a, like, there's a lot of personality, even though it's super deadpan.
Yeah, especially the deadpan of just saying Oprah, like, the Oprah stuff is just, like, we gotta bring this big, you know, like, Oprah. And it pays off, and the next scene is they go to the tech store and they buy the best security system cameras they possibly can, and this is when we meet Angel, our tech, who kind of gets wind of what they're doing and about, you know, he's like, something's there, and they're like, we'll install it, and the guy's like, you need like a rocket scientist or a tech person at the bare minimum to put this stuff together. I'll come out. The place is so far away. He's like, I didn't realize how far away this was, but he sets everything up and he's so curious because he's like, this is about aliens. And he gives them this whole spiel about UFOs being released. And this is something that really happened where they released all those, you know, UFO and those blips like a couple, like 2 years ago, like middle of COVID. And he's like, they just relabeled it to UAPs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he brings up ancient aliens and what they mean and all this stuff, and it was a good introduction to this character. But they're going to set up a trap. That is the plan.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, again, it's this idea of immediately the first thing that occurs to them upon seeing this thing is capture it, sell it, exploit it, market it. And I think, you know, like we see that a lot in movies, but I think that it's really driven home here that it doesn't represent anything else other than this opportunity to show it to others, to sell it, to market it. And so I think, yeah, like it, you know, it's obviously an allegory for capitalism and for our current sort of messed up system and for the film industry. But I think it's just a very human impulse as well that
we got to capture it.
We reflect on our greatness by corralling it, by capturing it. It's our mastery over the world. And I think it's like in a very kind of like Herzogian way. Like if you've seen those like classic, you know, like Aguirre, Wrath of God or Fitzcarraldo or all of those films where it's like literally Klaus Kinski on a mountain in a rainstorm, like
yelling,
screaming at the heavens, yeah, you know, like at God. And I think that is like obviously the Michael Wincott cinematographer character gets that moment of like
that
it's only if we can get the shot, get the footage, make it perfect, then we've conquered this thing somehow. Even more so than, you know, killing it, which is what Kiki Palmer sort of ultimately does. It's the controlling it, it's the owning it.
Possessing
it. And I think the very key as well, there's a scene where we cut to when they call Michael Wincott and they're trying to sort of hire him to come be their cinematographer. Mm-hmm. We find him and he's at home. He's got like a deck that he's like at an edit bay at his home. And it's just wild animal footage. It's like footage of animals fighting. It's no sense to what he's making.
No, it's in probably terms for like Discovery Channel or nothing, you know.
It's just clips of animals fighting. And it's again, it's that same thing. It's that you know, the ownership of them, the mastery of them, that he, you know, he's like this sort of god of nature because he's encased all of these animal fights in the camera, you know, like in that almost like in that you've stolen my soul kind of way. And I think that becomes so much the drive, like right away, that the OJ's very first thought is, let's go to Fry's. We're going to get security cameras. We're going to figure out what this thing is. And we're going to get the footage. Right.
Yeah. And they pull it. And then, like, his sister's just on board, right? She's like, great, the next adventure. Yeah. So, yeah, that is when we get do all that, and in the meantime, I mean, they do we do get what is a good setup, like right after this, for a traditional horror movie. Like, you basically, you're about to have our Signs moment, and then Jordan Peele just pulls the curtains above it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's almost, it's like, this is what you kind of thought, toying with the expectations.
Yeah,
like, this is what we thought the movie aliens was going to be. It's this alien invasion movie. Uh-huh. And then, yeah, like, that's kind of the signal that it's not that. And we're
going to
depart from that and do something else. But I think that the other thing about this movie is that I think that people got frustrated by the thing that's fun about it, which is that it's not one thing. It's not what you'd expect. It's not this straight line.
I think that's what's happening this year in horror.
Want the straight line. Like, they want to be told at 20 minutes in, like, here's what it is, alien invasion. And then you get to feel smarter than the movie. And this movie doesn't let you do that.
No, like, X was similar with that, right? It's not the movie you think you're going to go see.
I mean, kind of. I think that is even more.
It becomes
a slasher movie at some point.
Yeah.
But
you know what
the villain isn't sort of maybe who you'd expect, but
yeah,
I think in this one it's like, you know, it's segmented, and I mean it for a while it is about,
yeah, we're in Clover.
Right. For a while it's about these characters and this scenario and then the mystery, and then it becomes this kind of, you know, thriller where it's like they're in peril, and it's almost a horror movie where there's blood raining down from the sky. And I think, you know, in the last beat it becomes an action western where it's rousing and it's about them defeating the creature. And I think he's purposefully doing that. And I think it's fun if you let go of, I have to be one step ahead of everything every time or it doesn't work.
Like,
I think
Jean Jacket is the action movie.
Yeah, like, I think a lot of people have that, like, if the movie upends my expectations constantly, it's not cohesive. It doesn't hold together. I see that complaint all the time about movies. Like, oh, it's not it doesn't all hold together. And it's like, if it's entertaining the whole way through and you didn't know what was coming and it's enjoyable and you get something out of it, then it held together.
It held together, yeah.
That's what held together means.
I speak for myself, I don't know what they're talking about half the time, and they're, like, trying to say shit.
No, a lot of the time people are looking for ways to say I didn't like it that are not I didn't like it. They know they didn't like it, they don't know why, but they're saying I didn't like it in 18 different ways.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretentious, it was boring, it was this, it was that, I don't know what it meant, or whatever. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't hold together. You know,
hold like together is a one that, the way you pointed out, you're absolutely right. It's like, you just didn't like it, that's fine.
Yeah, just like that's
just fine. Say you didn't like it. We're right into it, though. Like, you have that scene with those kids, and it builds a nice tension with it. If you don't know the twist, or like, oh, these are the aliens, find out they're kids. And the reason why that is, they stole, Kiki stole the horse statue from the amusement park to use as bait. So now the Jupe's kids are gonna get back at him, and they fuck around and. You know, he punches one in the face, and anytime a kid gets hit in the face in a movie, I laugh. You can consensually laugh when a kid gets hit in the face. A little after that, I love when Dana Kaluuya is mentioning, he's like, it doesn't move like a spaceship. Like, we were talking earlier, it moves, it's animalistic, it moves, and there's also a new fun twist on the aliens, is that the saucer is the alien. Like, a little bit ago, and we kind of get shots of it, when we finally see, like, inside the being, but a little while ago, I covered Night Skies, or sorry, mm-hmm. Fire in the Sky? Fire in the Sky.
Fire in the Sky is the one with D.B. Sweeney, where it was based on the true story from the
90s. Yeah, so I covered that earlier this year, and doesn't hold up. I think everyone of a certain generation just remembers the trailer and the abduction scene, and it's scary, but everything else is pretty boring and rough, how we were talking earlier in the show.
Right. I mean, it's mostly the true story of this guy who worked on this crew in the woods, and then he disappeared, and it's sort of the... I like how they try to do that. They try to give the emotion of, like, what it would be like to be not believed and to be telling this crazy story to people. But it makes the movie very, like, it's an hour of this sort of like almost TV movie docudrama where D.B. Sweeney's like, no, you got to believe me. And then it's like 20 minutes of sci-fi freak out.
Yes,
where he's on
it
a
didn't
stage.
Click. And the only reason I'm bringing up this movie is they do the same things as like the spaceship had that birth count, right? And it's very...
it's a vent. I mean, in some ways, it's like an elevator compartment that just like squeezes people, crushes them in its sort of whatever.
And
maw.
The crazy thing is, like, what does the thing feed on? And I did want to know, maybe this is just me making a backstory. I think I feel like Keith David was like feeding the air, like he knew about it for some reason, was keeping it at bay. And it seems like this thing has always been in this area. I made that up.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a lot of textural evidence for that. You're
my mind
free
was
to have it as a theory, but
my mind was wandering. We could get rid of it. You could just
sort of feel like you would tell the kids at some point. Like,
we
don't
feed
mess
a horse
with that cloud.
Yeah, I'm wrong.
Like, that seems weird, but I don't know. Maybe
I'm wrong. That was just like I said, my mind kind of wandering with that. Sorry, where we're at. We are now, we move kind of more into the Gordy, title. And,
yeah, well, we get into the he's doing a show. Like, he's got his sort of version of the show that Steven Yeun is running, where he's
and
like,
to me, that was a big reveal.
It's a big, yeah, it's a big reveal on a few levels. I think one is it's maybe the most drive home. Like, I don't think this is a movie that's very polemical. Like, I'm going to shove my point down your throat. I think all the stuff we're talking about, you could take as just symbolism and like it's just a creature feature. I don't think you have to read any of this stuff in. But I think this is where it becomes the most pointed is like he's such a carnival barker type guy. Mm-hmm. And he's dressing this thing up and it's so cheesy. His vision of what this show would be and the heartfelt story narratives and
his
the kids
in alien
and
costumes and his wife.
And, right. And I think that's where Peele is really laying it on thick in terms of look at how ridiculous this man is and this show is and like what a joke that he thinks he's controlling this natural event in this way.
And then and that's where this part is where I was like, oh, it reminded me so much of we've been watching it. The thing when I said earlier, like the poltergeist, like of the chairs moving and shit. That's reminded me. It was like, well, now we're gonna show this to the audience and you're gonna watch this horse get taken by the thing because it's feeding time and it's been cool with us. And before that though, we get to see the 6 minutes and 13 seconds of the full murder of the fist bump of him under there and it being shot. And like you said, this just traumatic experience. It's all.
Yeah. Very... And I think it's a very powerful, like it's one of the better sequences I would say Jordan Peele has directed. It's very tense. It's very scary. Even though, you know, it's a flashback at the, it feels like you don't know what this chimp is going to do moment to moment. It's pretty chilling.
And I feel there's a part of it where you feel bad for the chimp. I mean, in the sense
of course, he doesn't know. The situation is wrong. It's not the chimp. A chimp shouldn't be made to act because they don't understand what acting is.
You know, he's kicking the shoe of like, hey, you wake up. I don't know why you're dead. Anyway, so we get there and the mothership come. I don't keep calling it the mothership, but you know, the saucer and comes and starts sucking it up. And you do see he keeps reinvited or keeps in touch with his old co-star who is
got mauled
forever mauled and deformed. And you know, she's there with a veil on her face. And
again, it's going back to the same. It's the same imagery, the same tension. Desperate to be seen. Life only has meaning when you're visual, when you're seen, when you're the focus of attention. But she's hideous now and hiding behind this veil. And, you know, she's a public figure, but she doesn't want to be looked at. And he even introduces her like, my first crush is here, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
And she gives a little wave, but you can't even see. She's obscuring her face. So it's like there's that tension comes up over and over and over again. The desire to be seen, the desperation to be seen, but also the desire to not be perceived. And how any being seen is being exploited, being used, being bought and sold and commodified.
Yeah. And they all get completely sucked up. And
I mean, that's like literally the image is people being sucked up and into this thing and then
into the camera.
I mean, it's
squeezed out.
Yeah.
And spit. And then
couldn't be
more
direct. Yeah.
Spit out. And then that is that the What are we calling this? The saucer, the jean jacket.
The creature, the alien.
Is not done. It goes over and it goes over to the ranch and you could hear the screams of everyone. You know, the her
yeah,
and
it's, very, it's. I mean, this is why I think the movie does get pegged as like there are horror elements.
Oh,
I mean, this monster stuff is definitely a horror sequence within the movie.
You hear the screams and like, you know, Kiki and Angel are in there and
it's raining blood on the house.
Well, that's just the I think the peak of
that's as like as you know spooky as the movie
yeah It's nighttime and he's raining blood and OJ is, OJ's in his car because it's not starting. Right. He's trying to run away and the horse comes shooting, one of his horses now comes shooting down and it's in his windshield and he just spends the night in there until it's over and he's safe. And I love the use of the slow "I wear my sunglasses at night" is playing because OJ has commandeered the vehicle that Angel was going to go home in because they had just finished up their day.
I kind of saw that as, I don't know if this is what Jordan Peele was thinking, but it's what made me think of. You know how trailers are constantly using like kind of artificially slowed down versions of songs to make them sound. In the meantime, the Space Hog one was just in Guardians 3.
Yes.
Where it's like 15% slower than the version that's on the radio to make it seem more like epic or meaningful. I felt almost like he was kind of tweaking that or playing around with that. Yes. Like it's not a horror movie because he even did in Us. He's got
five on that.
He's got the Loonies. I got five on it, and so I think this was almost like a tweak on that. That like I'm going to play this like weird otherworldly version of sunglasses at night.
I like it.
Slowed down because the alien is above. You know?
I'm a mark for that stuff. It was fun. But you're right.
I don't mind the slowed down songs. I think that works as much as it doesn't. But I'll tell you what I hate. It's the other thing that trailers do, which is the constant percussive drums. So you get like but and like I don't need the drums. I get like action is exciting even if there's not like those Japanese, it makes me think of those Japanese tall guys with the sticks and those huge drums. Like I don't know what they call that performance, but it's like every trailer has like 8 shirtless Japanese guys hitting those huge drums in the back constantly. Like, okay, they're in space. I get it. It's exciting.
That's good. That's another good a good kind of look at like what that probably was and he has used it and that is now becoming though. Well, the drums are there and I know exactly what you're talking about. But the slow song is it's getting overused. If I hear another trailer with like Imagine by John Lennon and sung by someone else in it, it's like we get it. You're a serious film. So they get the fuck out of there when they can. They go to Angel's apartment, and I think it was Angel who was like, "I'm not going back. I'm done. I mean, this is enough." And the curiosity and the hubris of OJ and Emerald are to go back and finish what they started. You know, they also feel like they just can't leave the ranch. And then they do it at this time though, we hear on the TV, we go back to that, what's his name? The cinematographer. We go back to his and the news reports 40 people are missing from the amusement park and you know, where are they? And it's a media thing now. There's eyes on it. People went missing and no one knows. It's the middle of nowhere. They do head back to the house, and this time they are going to get with that plan. And this is when they get the inflatable tube men and what's his name? Antlers. The cinematographer is, or I think they call him Holst more than not. Holst. He's going to use a crank camera, an old school crank camera, and to film the events. And this is the catalyst of they set everything up. We already spoke about that action, and this is when it becomes this action movie. And this is the jean jacket part. That we go through, and like you said, he puts on the Scorpion King jacket, and I know you have already alluded that has some symbolism. It's also just like kind of just a funny thing to wear. I've started buying my brother-in-law. Me and my brother-in-law have started buying each other gifts of movie hats because of On Cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, as Greg Turkington's always wearing a random movie hat. It's like the same shit, right? Like, it's such bizarre things. Like, I walk around with a Moonfall jacket on because it's the yeah, only
like, oh god part two or something yeah, like on cinemas the... they're so good at picking out those movies like what I would just, be a super random movie for Greg
I just got him the animal Rob Schneider's animal visor for Christmas
right yeah
yeah I have a moon this way has nothing to do with it. I have a Moonfall jacket because it's the perfect fall jacket and I have nothing else that way and you didn't see the little label it's just the members only
yeah
Yeah, on cinema, yeah, they're amazing. But we've, the last couple of years, started just exchanging those fucking... Two for the money is one of them. But anyway, so he has that, and it's such a good bit. And they are now going to lure the animal out. And now... now Daniel Kaluuya has let them know, but he's like, I think this is an animal. You know, these aren't aliens in what you think with the green head, the green bodies and the big head. This is an animal. That is the alien. And they listen, because what has he done his whole life? He has watched animals and how they behave. And they're set to lure that out. And Kiki Palmer, she's blaring the music from the window. You have Angel and Antler set up on the hill, and you have Dan Kaluuya. He's going to ride the horse around basically that track with the wacky inflatable tube men, and that's also going to tell us, you know, where that
right. Well, we figure out that the visual language is where the tube men are. You know, we can track sort of the creature just like they're doing in the film. It's a trick. I mean, it's a trick that a lot of filmmakers have used over the years. James Cameron does it in Titanic, where you get Bill Paxton on the ship at the beginning of the movie, and he shows you, like, see, the ship breaks here, mm-hmm. and then this part goes here. It's like, so when later it happens, you're like, oh, right, because the ship cracked
it out,
and this stuff goes here. He already told me what happened. And so in that same way, like, he's created his own rubric to help you follow the scene, which is very clever.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully, you know, James Cameron does that for us in The Way of Water.
I have not seen it yet, but hopefully. No. Yeah, I mean, James Cameron always, like, you could always rely on him. Like, yeah, they're very chaotic sequences, but there's always a through line.
By
you
this
where
comes out, the
is.
whole world will have seen it, I'm sure.
Oh, that's right. You guys will already know. You'll know The Way of Water. You'll
know The Way of Water.
The Riddle of Steel and The Way of Water.
Oh, it's, I know they're going to be good, but it's too fun to make fun of them. It's too much fun just to make fun of them.
I don't know. People are so hard. It makes it, it links up to what we're saying about Nope. Like, it's okay for a movie to be spectacle. I think what about the story? And it's like,
no,
not everything is about a story.
You shouldn't
not
be
everything
cynical.
Is a story.
There's nothing.
Sometimes it's a generic story you've heard 100 times and it's just there to like look cool and be badass and like make you feel good and like that's fine.
That's good. I love it. That's
fine. That does and like, oh, but it's only good in IMAX 3D, not at home. So go watch it in IMAX 3D. Yeah. Don't watch it at home, smart guy.
I do also like, I know they're jumping around and we're kind of near the end of everything. But it's the point of like, you know, we talk about these Spielberg movies, like we're talking about Jaws and everything. And it's like, yeah, but at the time of 1978, it's really 78, 75, whatever it came out. It's really, critics were like, this is just this pop. This is what they're saying about, you know, the spectacles today. They're like, it means nothing and blah, blah, blah. And then it's this classic that you study now. Like, this shit's always been there with these blockbusters.
I don't know.
We look at it. Anyway, I just always found that interesting about the blockbuster, right? It's like, you look at it later and you're like, that's important. But at the time, it's people were like, it's visual language.
These things are, it's generational. I think we don't like to even think about how much of this is sort of generational. And you get used to certain things. Certain things wear out their welcome. You get interested in more things as you go. Like we're not all going to have the same favorite movie. And you at different points in your life wouldn't have the same favorite movie of 2022. So that's why it's so ridiculous if I post my top 10 list and somebody comes in like, you don't have this one? It's
oh
like,
my God.
Even you in 5 years won't agree with you now, you asshole, let alone me. We never even met. Why would I agree with you? I'd probably think you're an idiot.
You're not going to remember Doubt. You're not going to put make your 2008 top 10 list and put Doubt on it again.
Yeah, but it's just like, but you change, everything changes. Yeah. The way you see things change, the way you perceive things change. It's always going to be different. And then, stop trying to make everything like a line.
But I think this movie is a good example, right, of that. There's the thematics in that about generations.
Sure. And I think this movie is a great example. And, of that. Yeah.
And even like, you know, thing of the technology, and it's a good movie that uses the technology doesn't work well. And it's like to film the monster, they're going back to the hand crank of what they used basically to film to start these people, their business.
The old fashioned camera.
Yeah, the old fashioned camera
Because they gave the electricity that the monster
takes out the electricity. Just saying, it works within generations. I'm also just trying to tie this back to...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this movie is a good... I do think this movie is a good example of the principle I'm talking about, which is that, I mean, it works as a narrative movie. I'm not saying it doesn't have a good story. I like the characters very much, and I do, they arc and they go on a journey or whatever. But I think that it's not easy to summarize. One sentence here to there. There's a lot of elements to it that are disparate. And I think one of the things that the movie's asking you to do is think for yourself about how it all ties together. How does Jupe's backstory tie in with the story of Jean Jacket, tie in with the story of the business that they're running and failing? Like, how do all of these elements sort of come together? I think he's like leaving that for you to figure out. And, you know, like, your take might not be the same as someone else's, and it doesn't function the way Get Out does, where it's a very tight narrative, where it's this, then that, then that, then we got to get out of here. It's like a through line. And, I mean, you know, some movies are like that and some aren't. I think everybody tries to put things in a box too often instead of engaging with them on their own level.
Yes. And it's a movie that, you know, it's one of those movies that if asked, then there's ones you do say, like, oh, it's about this. They fell in love. You know, it's a romantic movie. They fall in love and they're on they're in Hawaii. I don't know. This one is, hey, just watch it. I don't want to tell you anything because it's more about the spectacle and the experience of this movie than it is about worrying about the story. So anyway, we're back there, and right before they're about to begin the take out, the lure out the monster, a guy on a motorcycle drives up, an electric motorcycle, I believe it is, and rides up, and he's kind of, you know, Kiki Palmer comes running out of him, and she's like, what are you doing here? No, I'm nobody, like, get away. And it's TMZ. The guy starts pulling out a camera to record it, and, you know, she does shoo him off, basically, of like, whatever. But he drives into the experiment instead of away from it, and the guy gets shut down and stops, and our hero, Dana Kaluuya, is like, or in that moment is the hero, right? The music's kind of playing, and he does take the horse to go over to try to save him. But in an attempt that, the guy's so goddamn concerned with getting his camera and where's his camera out instead of, like, listening to the guy trying to attempt to save him. And then Kaluuya says, fuck that, and drives away and lets him get eaten. Mm. And that's when they have that great, this is when the base would just, the whole thing. The saucer still looks like the saucer. It's being lured out. It's on that side. He guy's cranking and reeling and got the shot. And we do get the sense like it's over now. That would all movies do that, right? We're like, it's over. And then the cameraman goes, no, I'm coming back. And he just stands out on the middle of that cliff, and I don't know what his thinking was. If he was possessed, I mean,
it's kind of mirror images those both of those characters. It's the thing I've been saying, you know, this whole time. It's the search for meaning. The capturing this thing is the only thing that matters. And if I don't capture it, I've missed this opportunity. That's the chance to create, the chance to put my stamp on it, the chance to own this moment. And so, yeah, I think that's what he's thinking, is that his whole life is about that, and about that desire to capture and own and to immortalize. And he is willing to risk his life. Both of those guys are willing to risk their lives. Although I think that Peele is sort of shading it differently. The guy on the motorcycle, we don't even ever see his face. He's sort of faceless. I think he just kind of I think it sort of represents that like it's purely about money. He's a brand. He's a corporation. Mm-hmm. It's not even like a real person. It's just this drive to earn and to make and to commodify and to buy and to sell. Whereas for Horst, you could read it as a more of a personal and artistic sort of a desire to, it means something to him. It's not just about money. He doesn't care about the money. He's doing this because he desperately wants to have this footage and to have shot this footage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, it's different reasons for the same thing, which is to sacrifice their lives in the pursuit of getting this shot, which sound, you know, we watch it in a movie and it sounds crazy, but you know, how many people have risked their lives to get an amazing shot or to make an amazing film? All the time. And you hear about dudes on YouTube, you know, they go and try to climb the skyscraper and take a picture and fall to their death. And I mean, it is a real human impulse that Peele is commenting on. It's not just a movie cautionary tale. I think it is a real thing. And I mean, Tom Cruise even hanging off the sides of airplanes and throwing himself into active volcanoes to make Mission Impossible movies.
Christ. That's a good point with that. It's just the human impulse to get that shot or to get it because you want to capture it and you're so enamored.
And then it moves beyond self-preservation. I mean, I think that, you know, there are a lot of things that we know can motivate people beyond self-preservation. Like if you are addicted to drugs enough, you will be motivated beyond self-preservation. And I think this is another variation of that like there are things that loom larger for people even than their lives. And I, you know, being immortalized, being iconic, being famous, being known as the person who did something, to be on Oprah is one of those things for a lot of people.
I love that. So Daniel does right away, right? I'm sorry, Danny Kaluuya does right away. And now that an angel's up there and he gets taken in by it. And that's one of the harder ones I ended up really liking that character. And, you know, he wraps himself. He's in like this kind of, tent. And he wraps himself
like an action thriller. It's like you got to imperil the characters. They've got to be almost, you know, it's like a Fast and Furious movie where the guy's about to fall and then Vin Diesel comes in and grabs him at the last second.
He's in there and he gets sucked up, and I mean, seemingly dies. He doesn't. I mean, that's like he gets spit back out, I guess, because of the barbed wire, this sort of false trap in that. More importantly, OJ and Emerald are kind of on opposite ends of each other, and the being is now coming for the house and from where Emerald is, and Dana Kaluuya basically just does another distraction to ride that away so she could get away on her bike. We're on the bike of the TMZ guy stolen, and it successfully works. He does that in exchange, may or may not have sacrificed himself for that, and she rides away and she rides back into the amusement park area or theme park, and you know, the now the being is for each other. It's this like angel like shudder, sometimes looks like one of those remind me of like the Chinese lanterns, kind of like the way the thing, everything folded out is very like origami like, and the color of it is very attractive green. And that's following her now. We're just seeing it follow her, and it's going through that, and she realizes that she lets up this, what, that big balloon of Jupe, of little Jupe in the cowboy outfit. She lets that up for it to kind of consume it, and she realizes this old Frank photo that they had, it was like this Western gimmick for people to take over, what was that, like a fountain-ish? You put your head over and you can take the photo. And she's cranking that, and like you said, still to get that shot, she's still desperate to at least try to see it out, because she thinks her brother's dead and everyone's dead, so why not go for it? And yeah.
It's that same idea again, but you know, in this version, like the rousing version, like mm-hmm. the she's gonna succeed
finally. It's gonna heroic, and she cranks it, it's very tense. She does get the shot. You see that creature thing out. She's exhausted. And then in the distance, it actually blows up because the big balloon boy was inflammable or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or
it pops. I read it as the,
it pops.
The way that the creature devours it, squeezes people. And like it compresses them before it like sucks the fluid or whatever.
Okay, yeah.
Whatever nutrients it's taking. So if it did that to a balloon, pop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. And, you know, so that's in the way in the distance. And then you hear like the masses of like police and news reporters kind of showing up. She's in the background, and it just ends on Kiki happy or relieved.
Right. Well, the iconic sort of shot, I think, is like then OJ on the
OJ's horse. On the horse.
We're reinventing the, you know, for the whole idea of, and I think this is where it becomes more like social commentary again, and like about the history of film, and you know, like for so long, even though black cowboys were real and were working behind the scenes as wranglers and stuntmen and coordinators, that there aren't black cowboy movies. You know, you don't think of like classic Hollywood black cowboy. But there are with exceptions. Woody Strode is in some classic. You know, there are.
They exist.
They do exist, but
in the general.
Yeah, I was thinking of The Professionals with Woody Strode. Did you ever see that one? It's a great 60s Western. Burt Lancaster also in that one. So there are black cowboys in movies. I don't mean to say cast aspersions, but it's not an iconic image until recently. We're just now starting to get movies that are playing around in that world, which is very cool. So I think like that, it's this creature is destroyed, this eye in the sky, this oppressive sort of monster. And now we do have this iconic image from an old movie of a black cowboy
on the cow,
having won the day, you know, like succeeding in the hero shot at the end.
And that is why I think he's alive.
Who?
OJ.
Oh, yeah, I don't read that as a dream sequence.
Oh, okay, that is a, because of...
I know there are people who assume...
Oh, I just read it as a lie because of that. It doesn't make... to me, it's not a movie that was benefiting from its skills. You know, there's benefit
We have no evidence that he died and she's just imagining him.
So, that is how it ends. Angel's alive, three out of the four are alive, and... Yeah. Lon, thank you for kind of getting me to watch this again and like think about it and talk about it, because I knew there was more to it than just, well, we were talking earlier, the spectrum, but I knew there was more to it than just, oh, I saw it. And, you know, earlier we were talking about, one time I tweeted out, and we were talking about this earlier, like, oh, people just come up with excuses of like, instead of I just didn't like it. And I tweeted, like, I had a tweet recently or a while ago. If I ever say, like, I need time to think about it, it usually means I didn't like it. This wasn't one of those cases. It was the rare time where I was like, I need some time to think about what I just watched before I say liked it or not.
I think that's another thing that, like, that's okay. It's okay to not have an answer right away. And I think, too, there's another thing that, you know, everybody wants to, like, conquer the movies. Like, we're afraid if we don't get them right away and don't unlock everything right away, that it's like you're stupid, and how did you not know that that's what it was about? And no, I if anybody ever calls you stupid for not getting a movie, like, it's not, it has nothing to do with that. And it like, sometimes things take a while to sort of unlock for you, and it doesn't mean that you're stupid.
One of my favorite rewatches was, ever, of this, coincidentally, was Us. I did not like Us the first time I saw it. I was like, it's fine, more so than not. And then I took about a year or so, I rewatched it. So I think I watched Get Out, and I was like, oh, let's give Us a, you know, I own them. And it was like, this movie's awesome. So you're right. Give it time. Give it a whatever.
Yeah, you gotta let it sit. There's no, you're not trying to beat the movie. You're not trying to conquer it. You're not trying to like file it away somewhere. Like, well, there's that answer. Put it in the box. It's like, it's art. You know, you engage with it or you don't on your own speed and your own time.
Anything that we, I feel like no, we covered a really like good amount of
it,
this movie.
We went through it scene by scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, that was going through it. I'm like, okay, like you said, there's not, the story wise, it's so simplistic that you have to break it up like that if you want to talk about it. Because then really it's like, yeah, there are a couple alien attacks, nothing really happens, and then the big thing, and then it explodes, and then bam, we're done. but awesome. But as always, thank you so much, Lon, for joining me to talk about this.
Yeah.
Sure. Anytime. Yeah. Anything you want to, well, I already asked that, Ed, but, you know, I know everyone could find Lon at Lon's, but anywhere else they need to find you or things you're working
on? Oh, I would just say, if you're a podcast fan, check out Binge Boys. That's my podcast with Hal Rudnick. Every few weeks, we watch a bunch of stuff on streaming services, and then I yell at him about how he didn't get it. So tune into that anywhere you get your podcast. We're on Spotify, Apple, all the usual suspects.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, and check out that. All right. Stay frightful, everyone. Bye.
Welcome to Flyover State of Fear.